From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Kirk Douglas, the actor who's played a champion boxer, the leader of a slave rebellion in ancient Rome, a suicidal artist, an aging train robber, and scores of other roles, has a new autobiography. Also today, we meet the writer who took the ghost out of ghostwriting. The best-selling autobiographies of Lee Iacocca, The Mayflower Madam, and Tip O'Neill were written with William Novak. It even says so on the book covers. Now he's working with Nancy Reagan on her life story. Also today, reviews of the new jazz album from pianist Curtis Clark and a new PBS documentary on Aretha Franklin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. One of Hollywood's biggest stars of the 1950s and 60s was also one of the first actors to run his own production company. Now he is the father of one of today's biggest stars and producers. My guest, Kirk Douglas, has made about 75 films, including Champion, Ace in the Hole, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Lust for Life, Paths of Glory, Spartacus, Lonelier the Brave, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Tough Guys. Douglas is the son of poor, illiterate Russian-Jewish immigrants. He chronicles his life on and off screen in his new autobiography, The Ragman's Son. Kirk Douglas has one of the most distinctive voices in film, and when his career was at its peak, it was de rigueur for every comic who did impressions to do Douglas in their act. I wanted to know what Douglas thinks of his own voice.
I never considered that I had a particularly good voice, although obviously it must be somewhat distinctive, because when people are doing imitations of me, they rely on certain aspects of my voice. But I am bad at imitating voices. For example, if I'm on the telephone and I try to pretend I'm someone else, someone says, "Oh, Kirk," and I thought I was giving a very good imitation of someone else's voice.
So you thought that there were certain shortcomings with your voice. Did you ever do anything to try to change it or improve on what you saw as its shortcomings?
No, I mean, I've taken the usual dramatic school, the usual lessons in voice production and all that. And I tried to make, I want a voice that comes out of me, not a voice that's, really very mellow and very deep and, And very often those beautiful voices are disconcerting. They don't seem sincere. You become aware of a beautiful voice instead of the feeling and thoughts that someone is saying. You know what I mean, Terry?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's hear how your voice sounded in 1949 in your first real starring role, the film Champion. And you played a boxer who the world sees as this just great idealized champion, but you've treated everyone like garbage on the way up.
That was one of the first anti-hero movies.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a scene from early in the movie. You've just won a fight. You realize you can actually box, but your brother, played by Arthur Kennedy, is worried about what he saw in you when you were punching away in the ring.
"I kept thinking you were hitting a lot of guys, different guys, all the guys that ever hurt you. I can't put my finger on it, but there's something wrong about that. I don't know if that's so good, especially in this business. And if you want to know, I don't like this business either. You're talking kid stuff, crazy stuff. Listen, I want to fight. My first fight, that's all. You hear that crowd? The first time in my life people cheering for me. Were you deaf? Didn't you hear them? Oh, Connie, wake up. Smell of coffee. Smell of steaks. I see you're learning, too. That's more like it. Get smart. I got my foot on the ladder. We're not hitchhiking anymore. We're riding."
You play a character who becomes more and more of a heel as he gets more and more successful. And I was wondering if that role set the tone at all for the kinds of roles you were offered afterwards.
Well, as I listen to those words, it's really the tone of the book that I wrote. It's the, I always say there's a part of every actor in each role that he plays.
Uh-huh.
And as I listen to that, I can see that while I was writing The Ragman's Son, that's the quality that I had a long time ago.
Which quality are you speaking of?
I mean, the quality of trying to get from nowhere to somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you start on the bottom, you have, as I tell my sons, they didn't have my advantage, because I had the advantage of coming from abject poverty, so I had nowhere to go but up. If I were born in a certain amount of affluence, I don't know what I would have done. See, so I had the stimulation, just as boxers today, they're hungry. In Champion, Mitch Kelly was hungry. He wanted to be champion. You know, when he says smell of coffee, smell of steak, he wanted to get somewhere. So he was properly motivated. And in a sense, I think my background, when I was writing this book, I learned an awful lot about myself, because you go through life and you forget. You get wrapped up in what you're doing. You get wrapped up in a make-believe world. The characters that I play in movies become more real to me than myself, things around me, because I'm so wrapped up in these characters that I'm portraying on the screen. And also, in years ago, unlike today, we did one movie after the other, so I was constantly having a great deal of myself in the world of make-believe.
Kirk Douglas is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography, which is titled The Ragman's Son. In the scene that we just heard, you give almost a little soliloquy there, and there have been several of your movies where, you know, one of your great moments in the film is a little soliloquy. And I was wondering if those are the moments that you really reach for, that you really like when you're acting in a movie, if that's, to you, the glory moment of a film or not.
Well, I don't think of it as a soliloquy. I think of soliloquies in Shakespearean plays, you know, to be or not to be, and all those things. But I suppose they are soliloquies in that you have a moment where someone expresses his innermost feelings. And then that particular moment that you displayed in Champion, that's a very key moment of understanding who this character was, and seeing that the other characters began to see a sort of viciousness in him that was almost frightening. You know, when Paul Stewart's character says, I don't know, when I looked at you, gee, it looked like you were killing everybody that you hated in your life. You know, they saw this element that was a part of that person. And in a strange way, is a little part of me, Issa Danielovich.
Mm-hmm. You started off in your first movie playing someone who was pretty weak in the film The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, and you went on to become a character who was seen as very strong. In fact, you mentioned that Ilya Kazan refers to you in his autobiography. And I'd like to read one of the things that he says when he was making the film The Arrangement, based on his best-selling novel. You wanted to be in the film, and he cast you in it, although he says there was something about the role that he thought Marlon Brando would have been better for. And Ilya Kazan writes, there was one problem with Kirk. Eddie, the character, has to start defeated in every personal way. The film rests on how basic and painful his initial despair is. Kirk has developed a professional front, a man who can overcome any obstacle. He radiates indomitability. Marlon, on the other hand, with all his success and fame, was still unsure of his worth and of himself. Acting had little to do with it. It was all a matter of personality. Did you ever think of yourself that way, as just radiating indomitability that affecting the kind of roles or could not do well?
Working with Kazan in The Arrangement was a wonderful experience. He's a great director. But I disagree with him completely. When I did Lust for Life, which I consider one of the most intriguing roles that I've played, I played a man completely unsure of himself. As a matter of fact, I sometimes tell my fellow actors that no one can play weakness better than I, starting with the very first movie that I did, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers. And then when you go to a character like Lust for Life, I remember the first time we showed that, and I described this incident in my book, where John Wayne was drinking at a party after a showing. He was very annoyed. He motioned me, brought me out on the balcony and said, he was very annoyed. He said, Kirk, how can you play such a sniveling, weak character? And I said, well, John, I said, well, you know, I'm an actor. It was an interesting role. I wanted to play it. No, he said, Kirk, we've got to play tough, macho guys. And he was really upset that I would be playing such a weak character. And you just read me a section where Kazan says that I just have that indomitable spirit, that he must have been carried away by some other movie, because if you look at Lust for Life, the pathetic, you know, tragic aspects of a man who really didn't know what he was, who couldn't sell a painting, who wasn't sure that he was... Was he a homosexual? He didn't know quite what he was. And that those were the facets of the character that excited me. Although most people, I think of me, the last movie I did with Burt Lancaster was called Tough Guys, as sort of a tough guy. But I love to play parts or try to find parts with different dimensions. You see, Terry, if I play a strong man in a film, I look for the moments where he's weak. And if I play a weak character, I look for the moments where he's strong, because that's what drama's all about, chiaroscuro, light and shade.
Mm-hmm. You were one of the first actors to actually start their own production studio. You produced Lust for Life, which you were just talking about. You produced Spartacus.
No,
you didn't produce that? I thought
I
you did do that.
I wanted to produce Lust for Life. I've produced Spartacus, Viking, mm-hmm. Paths of Glory, Lonely mm-hmm. Other Brave. I wanted to produce Lust for Life, and I went to buy it, and found MGM said, "We own it." And I said, "Oh, I want to play that part." And I ended up playing the part with Vincent Minnelli, but I didn't produce it, no.
Why did you want to start your own production company? Did you feel like you didn't have enough freedom as an actor?
You know, because that was a very unique thing at that time. But I wanted a production company so that I could find something that I wanted to do and then try to develop it. And sometimes I was very successful at doing that, Spartacus, Paths of Glory. But sometimes I was very unsuccessful, as when I bought One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and had it for 10 years and shopped it all over town, and nobody wanted to do it until my son Michael said, "Look, Dad, let's be partners. Let me see if I can get the money." And he went outside of the industry and got the money, and the rest is history.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the film Spartacus, in which you both starred and produced. I think it's an interesting movie for a lot of reasons, so I want to spend some time on it. Now, you had starred in The Vikings, and you write in your new autobiography, The Ragman's Son, that after starring in The Vikings, you thought, that's it, no more epics for me. And then you go and turn around and actually produce one of the real big epics, Spartacus. Why did you want to make an epic?
Well, I didn't want to make an epic. And one of the first things I said to my group, I said, "Look, if we do this picture Spartacus, let's make it as if it were a small picture." And to me, if you look at Spartacus again, you will find that the characters dominate the background. Most pictures, Ben-Hur and all that, the background is so enormous. But in Spartacus, Olivier, Lawton, Ustinov, Gene Simmons, the characters are stronger than the background, and that's what I try to do. In spite of the fact that it was an epic picture, I wanted the characters to be, for them to be larger than life.
You mentioned the characters and some of the actors. You ended up casting Gene Simmons in the role of Spartacus's lover and the woman who he has a baby with. And initially you didn't want to cast her because she's British, and you thought that that would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie, and I'd love for you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I have a very simple... For example, when I did The Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech, so that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great,
the slaves,
great stage actors, great British
right.
stage actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian. You, Jewish, Tony Curtis, Italian. No, Tony Curtis is Jewish too, actually, isn't
that's
he?
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I always forget that.
But it doesn't matter. You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played when it's done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended it.
So the slaves have the rough quality, and the Romans have the more genteel, educated, refined sound.
Exactly. Of course.
Now, is this intentional? Is this standard, or is this just something you wanted to do? Do you think it's pretty standard in in epics of that period to cast that way?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was just, you know, my way of looking at the picture. And of course, Spartacus, you picked on a picture that plays a big, is a big section in my book because so much happened during the making of Spartacus. The most historical event was the breaking of the blacklist. And that's one of the reasons that Spartacus is so important to me.
Well, that's right. Well, Dalton Trumbo was writing it under a pseudonym, like he was writing all of his screenplays at the time, because he was blacklisted. And you insisted that for this movie he actually use his real name. Did you think that the time was right where you could say, this is Dalton Trumbo who wrote the movie, and where it would actually be accepted, that the time was right to break the blacklisting and have it be accepted, at least in part of Hollywood?
Well, I'm not so sure. I did it rather impulsively. I don't think I was aware until a couple years later, as I reflected upon it, and like, you know, as I explain in my book, I began to see, you know, the significance of it. What bothered me when I did Spartacus was the hypocrisy in Hollywood, that these people, some of them who spent a year in jail for a crime that was never very clearly stated, I mean, were denied denied using their talents except behind the scenes. Studio heads would look the other way while a lot of these unfriendly 10 writers would be writing scripts for very little money. So it was so hypocritical that it annoyed me to the extent that I said, well, what happens? We had a discussion of whose name are we going to put on the screen of Spartacus. And suddenly I said, well, what happens if I put Dalton Trumbo's name on? And they said, oh, Kirk, you're bound. He said, you know, you're going to get out of the business and all that. I said, no, the hell with it. I'm going to do it. And the next day I left the pass. Dalton Trumbo hadn't been on a set in 10 years. I left the pass for Dalton Trumbo. No Sam Jackson. Of course, even Sam Jackson, we wouldn't have allowed on the set, somebody might have recognized him as Dalton Trumbo.
That was his pen name for this movie.
Yes, and from then on, I mean, I'll never forget when Dalton Trumbo walked on the set, came over to me and says, Kirk, thanks for giving me back my name. There were people who, I got letters from different organizations, had a hopper attack me, but the sky didn't fall in. And after that, a few months after that, Otto Preminger announced that Dalton Trumbo was going to be writing this script, and the blacklist was broken.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. Actor and producer Kirk Douglas is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography which is titled The Ragman's Son. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Kirk Douglas, and he's written a new autobiography titled The Ragman's Son. Since we're talking about Spartacus, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. And Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped from slavery. And after they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? Have we learned nothing? What's happening to us? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
We can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators. There's never been an army like that. One gladiator's worth any two Roman soldiers that ever lived.
We beat the Roman guards here, but a Roman army's a different thing. They fight different than we do, too.
We can beat anything they send against us if we really want to.
It takes a big army for that, Spartacus.
We'll have a big army. Once we're on the march, we'll free every slave in every town and village. Can anybody get a bigger army than that?
That's right. Once we cross the Alps, we're safe.
Nobody can cross the Alps. Every pass is defended by its own legion.
There's only one way to get out of this country. The sea.
What good is the sea if you have no ships?
The Cilician pirates have ships.
They're at war with Rome. Every Roman galley that sails out of Brundusium pays tribute to them.
They've got the biggest fleet in the world. I was a galley slave with them. Give them enough gold, they'll take you anywhere.
We haven't got enough gold. Take every Roman we capture and warm his back a little. We'll have gold all right. Spartacus is right. Let's hire these pirates and march straight to Brundusium.
Well, they get their army, and you, as Spartacus, lead them against the Roman army. When you were leading the army in the battle scene in Spartacus, was the real actor Kirk Douglas worried about production costs?
No, as a when you're acting, even though you have a production company, you try to cooperate with your the people who are financing the production. But as an actor, that's my most important aim, my most important concern. So believe me, when I'm playing a scene in Spartacus, I can't be thinking about production costs.
I think the battle scene in Spartacus where the slave army and the Roman army fight is one of the most interestingly choreographed movie battle scenes. The slaves are massed in almost a checkerboard foundation formation. There are people in the slave and the Roman army, as far as you can see, it is this huge vista of people. And I'm wondering what your most vivid memory of being in the middle of all of that is.
Well, you see, all of that was historically accurate. We studied how Romans fought, you know, and how they arranged their armies. And, of course, that was a scene. We shot the entire picture in the United States, except those scenes which we shot in Spain, because you needed so many people, and we used lots of Spanish soldiers. The battle scenes were all shot in Spain because it needed thousands of people.
You know the scene where the slave army gets started by burning logs in front of the army, and then they roll the logs down the hill, so these flaming logs force the Roman army to retreat, and you see in the movie a lot of Roman soldiers getting burned by these logs. How'd you do that?
Well, listen, those are the scenes. We don't discuss how we do. You don't have a magician telling you how you do a trick. That was a very effective device that we had a very talented director, Stanley Kubrick, who was doing it. But that in itself is not a very difficult thing to shoot, to have burning logs rolling into soldiers, but it was very effective.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. The body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
Okay, so that's the secret. Kirk Douglas is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography, which is titled The Ragman's Son. You quote your wife in your book, who once said to you, it's an unnatural life just being wrapped up in make-believe characters. You've played so many different characters through the course of your career. Were you ever confused about who you really were as opposed to who the characters you played were?
Well, the only time I encountered something similar to that was in playing Lust for Life. Van Gogh really was a painful character to play. And it was so easy to study his character because there's a whole book of letters that he wrote to his brother. And reading those letters, you could understand him so perfectly. And shooting the picture, we shot it in Auvers-sur-Oise and Arles, Les Baux, all the places that Van Gogh lived. And when I came to the town of Auvers-sur-Oise, where Van Gogh died, and I had this stubby red beard and kinky red hair in the outfit, a lot of the old-timers, they say, il est retourné, They actually felt as if Van Gogh had come back. So there was an amazing resemblance that I must have had to Van Gogh, and that all affected me. And the poignancy of that role did really get to me, and it destroyed my original concepts of what acting is all about, where you're supposed to have the discipline of knowing that this is make-believe. And I never watched Lust for Life until about 6 months after it was finished. I just didn't want to even be close to it. It was a painful experience.
You know, we started this interview with me asking you about your voice, which is surely one of the most distinctive facets of your acting style. I want to ask you something about you physically in terms of your acting. People think of you, they think of your voice. Physically, they really think of the dimple in your chin. And when you started acting, was there ever a time where that was seen as a disadvantage? Did anyone ever try to cover that up with makeup?
Oh, yeah. The first time I came to Hollywood, you know, and they're looking at this Broadway actor, there was talk of, and they did, they filled it up with putty.
Really?
It had to be an awful lot of putty because I don't have a dimple in my chin. I have a hole in my chin. And it annoyed me. I said, look, I just pushed the putty out. I said, look, this is what you get if you want it. I'm not going to change it. So let me know if this is what you want or I'm going back to New York. And that was the end. I mean, and since then, I've never, you know, it's a part of me.
So you never let them actually shoot you with the putty in your chin?
No, because if I wanted to play, oh, I would do that if there was a real reason where I wanted someone to have like a big lantern jaw and covering up this dimple in my chin would give me that effect. I would do it if the reason was to play a certain character or it's covered up when you have a beard. I mean, I do whatever I feel you have to do to play the character, not for, you know, vanity's sake. I am what I am. I can't change that.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Kirk Douglas, and he's written a new autobiography titled The Ragman's Son. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be film director Sidney Lumet, whose movies include 12 Angry Men, Serpico, Prince of the City, Network, The Verdict, and a new film titled Running on Empty. I hope you can join us. Here's a scene from one of Kirk Douglas's many films, Young Man with a Horn. He plays this scene with Doris Day and Lauren Bacall.
I want you to meet an old friend of mine, Amy North. This is Rick Martin.
Hello.
It isn't there anymore.
Well, what?
The expression on your face, your whole mood. When you were playing that trumpet, you were exalted, sure of yourself. Now you've undergone a rather startling transition, Richard. I'd rather call you Richard than Rick. You don't mind.
Well,
people try to find security in a lot of strange ways. You seem to have solved your problems. At least while you're playing that trumpet.
I don't understand a word you're saying, but I love the sound of your voice. You got a wonderful rough spot.
I should have warned you about Amy. She always talks like a medical book and likes to analyze everything. She's studying to be a doctor, Rick, a psychiatrist.
Oh, well, how do I stack up?
My interest isn't purely professional. When I meet someone who has a great talent, I want to know him right away. You don't mind, do you?
No. Go on.
Tell me about jazz. Do you think it's purely African?
I don't know. I don't do much thinking about it. I just like to play it. If you listen to it enough.
I didn't come here to listen to it. I came to study the people, watch their faces. They're interesting. There's something about jazz that releases inhibitions. It's a sort of cheap, mass-produced narcotic.
I gather you don't like jazz.
Not particularly. Oh, I know it's supposed to be our native art. Cotton fields, the levees, old New Orleans, and blues in the night.
Excuse me, please. Would you do a number?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. William Novak is now working on his fifth autobiography. He's not an egomaniac. He's what used to be called a ghostwriter. His autobiographies are those of other people, including Lee Iacocca and the Mayflower Madam. Coming up, William Novak talks about his latest project, Nancy Reagan's life story. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from pianist Curtis Clark and his quintet. Clark's an expatriate who's lived in the Netherlands for the past 7 years. Kevin says you can hear it in his music. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the latest offering on public television's American Masters series. Usually the show has a highbrow orientation, but this time the subject is the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman. In Poland tonight, government troops are moving into major industrial plants and curfews are being imposed in provinces hit by a wave of strikes. The nation's interior minister says the strikes raise a specter of anarchy over the country. Riot police are reported to have forcibly evicted strikers from bus depots in the city of Szczecin and have detained at least 150 workers. Earlier today, workers at the Gdansk shipyard became the 13th group to join the nationwide strike. Workers are demanding higher wages and the recognition of the banned Solidarity Union. The South African government has used its state of emergency powers to ban the activities of the country's main anti-draft movement. The End Conscription Campaign has mobilized against the country's two-year draft, which is compulsory for all white males. From South Africa, Nigel Wrench has a report.
The Minister of Law and Order said the End Conscription Campaign was helping what he called the revolutionary onslaught because it encouraged whites not to do their military service. The ban on its activities is the government's response to the anti-conscription movement's new high-profile strategy. It culminated 2 weeks ago when 140 young men publicly refused to undergo military training. They said they regarded the South African Defence Force as an apartheid army. Opposition to army service has escalated sharply since soldiers were first sent to quell black protests in the townships 5 years ago. The government's action today is obviously aimed at stopping the increasing rebellion to military service. Unofficial statistics show that thousands dodge the draft every year. For National Public Radio, this is Nigel Wrench in Johannesburg.
According to a Reuters report, a formal ceasefire accord was signed today between South Africa and the combined Cuban and Angolan delegations, ending the hostilities in the 13-year-old Angolan Civil War. The reported agreement provides for the establishment of a joint monitoring committee to oversee the ceasefire. The accord follows a series of meetings last week between South African, Angolan, and Cuban officers and sets up a September 1st deadline for the withdrawal of South African troops from Angola. In addition, it stipulates that South Africa will end its 7-year rule of Namibia. The deal also calls for the eventual withdrawal of the 50,000 Cuban troops, though details on that have yet to be worked out. Government authorities in Burundi now say at least 5,000 are dead and 35,000 have fled the country following last week's ethnic massacre in that tiny Central African nation. Some reports had the death toll as high as 24,000, but government officials called the report highly exaggerated. Last week's massacre is another in a series of tribal clashes. Federal authorities today began deportation procedures against a 79-year-old Minneapolis man accused of Nazi war crimes in the Soviet Union. Stephen Smith of Minnesota Public Radio has the story.
The Justice Department filed a lawsuit today against Edgars Indy, a native of Latvia who allegedly belonged to a commando unit that assisted the Nazis in killing unarmed Jews and other civilians in Latvia during 1941 and 42. The civil suit is the government's first step toward revoking Indy's citizenship and deporting him. A person answering Indy's telephone in Minneapolis referred reporters to a New York State lawyer who refused to comment. When contacted by the Associated Press, Indy reportedly denied killing Jews. According to the suit, he was ineligible to immigrate or become a U.S. citizen because he concealed his wartime past. He arrived in the U.S. in 1949 and became a citizen 6 years later. Indy has 20 days to respond to the complaint. A Justice Department statement says the government is prosecuting others who were involved in the Latvian auxiliary police, including defendants in Seattle, Chicago, and Syracuse, New York. For National Public Radio, this is Stephen Smith in St. Paul.
Talks between North and South Korea broke down today, and there were no further mention of later discussions. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The city a musician chooses as home can influence his or her music. Pianist Curtis Clark was born and raised in Los Angeles, but became dissatisfied with the music scene there. He tried living in New York, but finally settled in Amsterdam. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Clark might be better known if he'd stayed home, but his music probably wouldn't sound the same.
A couple of weeks ago, I was reading an account of a notorious schism that sprung up in France in the 40s among jazz critics and fans. They were split over whether the new music of bebop was the next big step or one big mistake. Lifelong friends fell out, never to speak again, and factional riots would break out in concert audiences. Before now, this display of partisanship has always amused me. Jazz is serious stuff, but these guys were making like Stalin and Trotsky. Reading about it this time, though, I was not so amused. It sounded a little too much like what's happening in America now. The neoconservatives dislike the free boppers and vice versa, and neither group has any use for mellow new age players. Pianist Curtis Clark left the U.S. for Amsterdam about 7 years ago, and while he's kept up with stateside developments, he's pointedly ignored the divisive attitudes brewing back home. Clark's new CD on Santa Monica's Nimbus label is Letter to South Africa. His quintet includes cellist Ernst Reisiger, who on the title track seesaws between new age mildness and free jazz raunch. Ernst Reisiger on pianist Curtis Clark's composition, Letter to South Africa. Reisiger's blend of the mournful and the rebellious fits the subject. It takes complex music to reflect complex problems. But South Africa is more than a state of mind to Curtis Clark. His tune, Serious Wishing, dedicated to Winnie Mandela, has the folksy flavor of South African jazz. The tenor saxophonist is John Chikai. Serious Wishing's mix of the lighthearted and the plaintive is typical of Curtis Clark. He sounds radical because he treats everything as normal. So his music's prone to mood swings. Here's Clark on his tune, What Price Freedom, whose gospel melody owes a bit to South African pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. Thank you.
Curtis Clark's search for unity and diversity is symbolized by the makeup of his band. Veteran saxophonist John Chikai is black and Danish. Cellist Ernst Reisiger and bassist Ernst Glarum are Dutch. Drummer Louis Maholo is a South African in self-imposed exile. In a way, Clark is a political exile too. He left the States and its musical politics behind to be free to be eclectic without censure. But while Clark borrows liberally from several genres, his music has a personal stamp. Most everything he plays has that melancholy undercurrent we often find, or think we find, in an expatriate's art.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Curtis Clark's new album, Letter to South Africa, on the Nimbus label. This is Fresh Air. William Novak was in his mid-30s when he took on his first ghostwriting assignment. The first thing he had to decide was, should he address his collaborator as Lee or Mr. Iacocca? But the bigger worry was whether anyone would want to read Lee Iacocca's life story. Novak spent 40 hours interviewing Iacocca and a year and a half writing the book. Iacocca, an autobiography, became a runaway bestseller, and Novak's career was launched as the writer famous people turn to when they want to tell their life stories. After Iacocca, Novak went on to work with Sidney Biddle Barrows, The Mayflower Madam, Tip O'Neill, and Natan Sharansky. He's currently writing a book with Nancy Reagan. He's one of the writers credited with making the ghostwriter visible and elevating collaboration to a respectable and lucrative profession. When Novak writes an autobiography, he gets shared credit on the book's cover, an idea that came about unexpectedly.
When I was offered the Iacocca book, and the publisher and I were not in 100% agreement on what the fee should be, they said, but you can always have your name on the book. They offered my name on the book in lieu of additional money. And I thought that was an interesting offer, but having never done a book like this, I wasn't sure I wanted my name on the book. Back in 1982, when this project came about, it wasn't clear to me that this was respectable work. It still had a kind of a negative tinge on it. And I had it written in my contract that it would be my decision at the end whether or not my name would be on the book. I wasn't sure I would like the book, but I did, and my name was on it, and of course I'm very glad it was.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of famous people on the occasion of the publication of their autobiography, and many of them tell me about the agony of facing the blank page every day while they're writing their book. And I, of course, think to myself that agony is probably really being experienced by the person who's writing the book with them. Now, when you're writing a book with somebody, do they write a first draft?
Only one person I've worked with has actually taken pen in hand. That was Natan Sharansky. He wrote an entire first draft. It was translated, and I worked from the translation and with him to add, expand, and enliven it. But normally the people do most of their work through conversation with me.
So what do you do exactly? What's your style? You do a long series of interviews with the person who you're writing about?
Yes. The trickiest thing at first is usually to get enough time with my partner, my writing partner. And I go in person and sometimes supplemented by phone calls, and tape, get as much on tape as possible, 50 hours, 100, even 200 hours on tape. I ask questions. I encourage them to go on their own tangents. As long as the material is not repeating itself, almost anything they tell me is potentially useful for a book. I find that a book is a very large package to fill. The more I have on tape and then transcribed, the more secure I feel that I'll be able to write that book.
Now, as a reader, I suppose I should feel that the person whose book this is telling me in their own voice about what their life has been like. How did you learn how to write in the voice of somebody else?
I learned by doing it wrong. I guess that's the best way to learn. When I first handed in half of the Iacocca book, The publisher, Bantam Books, rejected it. They said, this is too well written. Now, this was a problem for me. I'd spent my whole life as a writer trying to be a good writer, and it was certainly the first time I'd ever had material rejected for being, in quotation marks, too well written. But they were right. It was literary. It did not sound like Lee Iacocca sitting in your living room. That's what they wanted, and that's what I had to go back and learn. I had to create with less literary artifice. I had to put less of myself and much more of the person I was working with. And I had to make it casual, and I had to break a number of the writing rules I had learned along the way.
Such as? What's a rule you had to learn to break?
Well, I had to be willing to use more clichés if the person used clichés. I had to start sentences with but and. I had to write in a more casual and informal way than I had been used to. And it took some getting used to. I still don't find it easy.
When you're writing somebody's autobiography, do you take their word on everything, or do you fact-check and play the role of journalist? For instance, if Sidney Biddle Barrows, the Mayflower Madam, tells you that all the women who worked for her really respect her, that they got along really well, that she was always on their side, are you going to call up some of the women who actually worked for her service and see if they agree?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because in no other book did I have as many questions as I did with Sidney. This story was simply too good to be true. And for that reason, and also to supplement the book, I told her I'd like to interview some of, as she called them, the girls who worked for her. And to my great relief, and to some extent to my surprise, they corroborated her story one after another, but in very different ways and in their own words. And that was very reassuring to me, because I don't want to tell a story that is not true. At the same time, in every book I'm associated with, and in every autobiography ever written, there are untruths. That is, everybody sees the world differently, and my job is to help the person tell the story as they recall it and as they want to present it.
Do you have to convince the people you're collaborating with to talk about their defeats as well as their triumphs, to talk about the things that might be embarrassing to them but are actually going to be very interesting to readers?
That's a good and important question. I said to one of these people, you know, you'll have to tell me also about your mistakes. And he said, he thought for a minute, he said, Bill, I can't think of any. The rest, I've told others that story, others with whom I've worked, and they all agree that they must discuss their mistakes. But we have a way, all of us, I think, of filtering them out and concentrating on our successes. But, of course, for a book to be credible and interesting, it's much better if it includes some mistakes and some roads that perhaps should not have been taken.
Now, the book that you're working on now is an autobiography of Nancy Reagan. You're working with her on that. Did Nancy Reagan choose you, or was it the publisher's choice?
Well, I think in these cases, you have to be approved by both parties. And what happened here was Random House called me one day and said, there's a possibility that we might ask you to work with the First Lady, Nancy Reagan. How do you feel? And I said, let me think about it. And I asked my wife, I said, what do you think about Nancy Reagan? She said, just say yes. I went back, I said I'd be happy to meet Nancy Reagan. At that point, I still believed what I was reading in the papers, and I wasn't entirely sure I wanted to work with Nancy Reagan. When I met her, I found that her public image was completely misleading, that this was a warm and kind and thoughtful and intelligent and funny person, and I immediately signed up and hoped she would choose me, which she did.
Now, Nancy Reagan is best known in her work for her Just Say No campaign, and several of the People pages of magazines and newspapers have reported that one of your previous books was called High Culture, Marijuana in the Lives of Americans, and that about your own experiences, you wrote in the book, for me, marijuana has been an intellectual stimulant. Did she know that you'd written that book when she chose you?
5 minutes after my first meeting with her agent, I said, there is a potential problem here. I have written a book that could be embarrassing, and I want to be clear about it, because I foresaw this happening. And when it did happen, when the press did link up these two projects, I was very glad that I had informed the White House, and there was no problem, because they had been told.
So there's no Novak gate here?
No, apparently not.
She reacted.
That book on marijuana, which was my first, was written in a previous era, in a previous period in my life, and we go on and do other things, all of us.
You've written several bestsellers, but those bestsellers have been other people's autobiographies. Your own books haven't sold nearly as well. Do you want to parlay the success that you've had with the autobiographies into being able to write more books of your own?
I'll tell you, the things I would like to write about, whether it's, for example, the spiritual lives of American Jews,
mm-hmm.
or the people in this country who are behind the nascent tofu industry. I have some fairly eccentric interests, which I don't think would necessarily be the stuff for bestsellers. So as long as I want to make a living at this, I might be advised to continue doing what I'm doing, which I happen to enjoy very much. People sometimes ask me, but how can you stand doing work for which you don't get so much credit? I get more credit and more attention for writing these so-called ghostwritten projects than I ever did for my own work.
Have you ever thought about how you would write your own autobiography if you were writing about yourself?
My wife, you know, jokes that she would like to carry a sign into a party that says, with William Novak. And people sometimes say, boy, you ought to write about all the people you've met. I'll tell you, the people I've met have told me some wonderful and fascinating things, but those are all used up in their books. My life is like any journalist or writer, spent mostly by myself, locked up in a room typing. And it's not all that interesting. I don't think my autobiography is a future bestseller at all. And I think it's best unwritten.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking with us about writing.
Thank you.
William Novak is working on two books, Nancy Reagan's autobiography and an anthology of recent American humor. This is Fresh Air. Looking ahead, let's see what they have planned on All Things Considered. Co-host Renee Montaigne is with us. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, one of our top stories tonight is Poland. In Poland, labor protests are spreading, and neither the government nor the strikers show any sign of backing down. Also, as we all know by now, Republican presidential candidate George Bush has been going round and round all week about his choice of Vice President Dan Quayle's military service during Vietnam. Today, Vice President Bush spoke before the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Chicago, and he got a great reception.
Are you doing a Monday pick of the week?
Yes, we are. Today I talked to Rai Cooter, the ever-eclectic Rai Cooter. He says his ideal music is the kind you might hear in an old hotel filled with potted plants where people like to dance.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Singer Aretha Franklin rarely gives interviews, but you can hear her discuss her career, see film clips of her performances, and hear from people who have worked closely with her this week on public television. The Queen of Soul is profiled on the American Master series. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
Don't play that song for me, 'cause it brings back memories of days that
That's the voice of Aretha Franklin, and most people, at least the ones I know, can identify it pretty easily. Now here's another voice of Aretha Franklin, one that's a lot less familiar.
I think that my dad felt that I was gifted or uniquely talented as a child, yes. He would coach me in different things. He would give me different records to listen to and to see if I could emulate them on the piano. Different vocalists to listen to.
This week's edition of American Masters is called Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, and it tells why she was honored with that rather royal compliment. One of the most remarkable things about the show is what you just heard, the amazing contrast between Aretha's unrestrained singing voice and her very restrained speaking voice. Not once in this PBS documentary does her speaking voice show much emotion or rise above a monotone. But the singing, well, that's different. This co-production between the BBC and American Masters executive producer Susan Lacey is loaded with great music and memorable visuals. Aretha's long and varied career is retraced, beginning with her solos with her father's church choir to her first record contract. It was with Columbia Records where executives there made the mistake of advising her to cover their choice of material.
Mark, yeah, King, yeah, boy.
She finally got respect, so to speak, when she moved to Atlantic Records in 1967 and scored with a string of hits that vaulted her to the top of the pop charts. Lots of musical highlights and live performances are included in this documentary, but none surpasses the news footage from the funeral service of Martin Luther King Jr., where the slain civil rights leader's favorite singer tearfully performs his favorite song.
Because you're a present, Lord. And I know you'll reach out and take my pain.
This documentary isn't flawless by any means. It glosses over Aretha's personal life, mentioning and dismissing in one sentence, for example, that she had two kids by the time she was 17 and was married for the first time at age 20. It also has gaps in its research. The show never even says when she originally got the nickname the Queen of Soul or who gave it to her. Even so, it's nice and interesting to see a pop music figure given the American Masters treatment. This series in the past has profiled Charlie Chaplin, Duke Ellington, and Georgia O'Keeffe. Now, by profiling Aretha Franklin, it seeks out expert testimony from the likes of Keith Richards, Dick Gregory, and Eric Clapton. The times, they've changed all right.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Oh, happy day.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with film producers Griffin Dunn and Amy Robinson. The pair produced Baby It's You and After Hours. Their new film, Running on Empty, is directed by Sidney Lumet. Also, rock historian Ed Ward recounts the early days of the great Ray Charles. So I hope you can join us. We'd love to hear from you. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Ed Doherty. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.